So Matthew 16, I think we're going to finish the chapter. You go ahead and read through the passage first. Matthew 16, starting in verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels and the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom." So we've said over the last few weeks, as we've been working through the passage about the great confession, Peter's great confession that Jesus is the Christ, we've said that this is kind of a turning point in the gospel. And to give you kind of an idea of how much that changes in the gospel, we were just looking at this morning. There have been, up until this point in Matthew's gospel, 16 chapters, there have been at least 12 healing miracles. So Jesus has healed at least 12 people specifically, and there have been 5 times in which Matthew has actually provided a summary in which Jesus just heals tons of people. So we got, 17 different times up until this point, not including just the miracles of multiplying the bread or whatever, just healing miracles. After this point, there's only 2. So think about this. From this point on, the moment Jesus says, "Now that you've confessed that I am the Christ, let me tell you what the Christ is going to do," or "let me tell you what is going to happen to the Christ," everything changes. So even in his life, even in his ministry, even in the writing of the gospel, this is a major shift that's taking place. Now we get to see what is going to happen to the Christ. Now we get to see what is going to happen to the king. And what's going to happen to the king is his coronation. He's going to enter into Jerusalem as the celebrated king, and he takes his throne not in the temple, not in the palace, but he takes his throne on an old wooden cross on top of a mountain that's called Golgotha, this skull mountain, this death mountain. That's where Jesus is coronated. That's where he's enthroned. That's where he becomes king. So that's where the passage is going. That's where the gospel is going. So that's the heart of the passage. The repercussions of that, or the consequences of that, there's significant consequences for the disciples. If they are going to follow this king, then what is going to happen to them is the same thing that happens to him. So there is the emphasis upon the crucifixion and what that means for the disciples, that they must take up cruciformity. They must be conformed to the cross. They themselves are going to follow Jesus on the death march. So keep those two things in mind. Notice the shift that takes place here in verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things. From that moment. So you see this emphasis then upon the confession that he is the Christ and how that changes Jesus' approach to the disciples. Yes, they've gotten to the point where they see that he is the Christ. Perhaps the miracles reinforce that. Perhaps they help them to see that, yes, this is the coming one. This is the promised son. This is the one that's going to bring healing. And he shows it by healing others. But Jesus is going to tell them now, from now on, the emphasis is on the cross. So, the passion. We have this passion prediction by Jesus. We have Peter's rebuke of Jesus and Jesus' rebuke of him. And then we have the call to follow the Christ. So let's work through these points and see how this is developed. So, notice that we kind of skipped over last week, verse 20. So look back at verse 20. Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. Okay, this is kind of, I think they call it like the messianic mystery or something like that. It's kind of more emphasized in Mark's gospel, where the only ones that seem to know who Jesus is are the demons. And, you know, he tells them to be quiet. And of course, he tells the disciples, really, don't tell anybody that I'm the Christ. And there's probably a practical reason for that, but I think Matthew's point in showing us is basically reinforced by this passage. Why did he not want them to go and tell everybody that he was the Christ? Because no one knew what the Christ had to do. No one knew what was necessary for him to do. No one knew what he must do. If Jesus had said, verse 21, before the disciples confess that he is the Christ, they would have never confessed that he is the Christ. Because kings don't die. Christs don't get crucified. Okay, that's just obvious to every single person. The kings are not supposed to be hung up on a cross. So he waits strategically, you know, maybe, to get them to the point where they recognize that he is the Christ, and then he, even though they don't know what they're actually meaning when they confess that, at least they definitely don't know in full, maybe a little bit, and then he starts to explain to them what that actually means. So, he warns them, you know, it's such good news that he is the Messiah, right? You'd think he would want everybody to share that. Go out and tell everyone that he is the Christ. But no, he warns them, he charges them strictly not to tell anyone that. He doesn't want anyone to have a wrong impression of what it means for him to be the Christ. So this passage is at the beginning in which he starts to unpack that for them. So he shares with his disciples the things that must happen to him, the things that are necessary for him to do. Jesus gave the disciples some time to come to their own conclusion about who he was, but once they arrived at the right conclusion through the revealing work of the Father, he was determined to show them what this means. He did not want them to have a faulty view of the Christ. He wanted to prepare them for what was going to happen. He wanted them to know what it was that was going, that what it was that was going to shape their discipleship. Though this would happen, they would fully understand, and not until Pentecost, they would remember what he said. Now they have no idea what's going to happen to him. They're thinking that he's going to ride into Jerusalem, rally the people, build an army, and go and overthrow the Romans. That's what they thought was going to be the work of the Messiah. But now, it's different. Notice what he says. He began to show his disciples. So this is interesting, you know, connection. The Pharisees demanded that Jesus show them a sign, and here Jesus is showing his disciples what's going to happen to him. He must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed, and on the third day be raised. There's a couple things just to notice here. This is going to be the first of three predictions of his passion in Matthew's gospel. Notice the necessity. So he must go. This is not an option for him. You know, if it was quite an option, right? Do you want to go and be crucified, or would you rather do something different than that? But this is necessary for this to happen to him. He must go and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed. and on the third day be raised. This is a divine necessity for Jesus to go to Jerusalem as the Messiah and be killed, to suffer, and to be raised. This is not just a conspiracy. This is not just an attempt by the religious leaders to get rid of a nuisance. It's not even an attempt by the Romans to get rid of an insurrectionist. This is God's plan for Jesus. This is God's plan for his son. It is God's will. This is his destiny. This is what must happen. And we've seen little bits and pieces in the gospel about these events. So we've already seen that the Pharisees have conspired together to find a way to get rid of Jesus. We've already seen what happens to prophets in Jerusalem, is that John the Baptist, he gets his head cut off. And we've seen Jesus even talk about the sign of Jonah. I'm not going to give anyone a sign except for the sign of Jonah. Just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish for three nights and 3 days, so the Son of Man will be in the heart of the earth, right? So we've already kind of anticipated this to happen, but here he gets very specific. He's going to suffer, he's going to be killed, and he's going to rise, or he's going to be raised, right? The divine passive there. God is going to raise him up. Now notice too that Peter understands what Jesus is saying. So Peter understands that Jesus is talking about his own death, his own suffering. And that's why he takes him aside very gently, carefully, and rebukes him. So they don't understand a lot of what Jesus says, but when Jesus tells them that the king is going to die, they get upset. And they have to set Jesus straight. They got to correct him. Now, I think that this is somewhat telling, right? He addresses him as Lord. But if there is any sort of sense in his mind that Jesus is the Son of God, right? The Son of the living God, but yet that meaning not just David's descendant, but yet in some way an incarnate Lord. This is the incarnate God. I don't really think there's a whole lot there in his mind. But think of how presumptuous and bold this rebuke is that he provides to Jesus. Jesus just tells him, this is the guy that they've been following for 2 years. Jesus just tells him that he's going to Jerusalem and it's necessary for him to die. And then Peter takes him aside and tries to correct him. Say, this is not God's plan for you. This is not necessary. This does not have to happen. Actually, far be it from you. This shall never happen to you. There's like a double negative there. So this is not really going to happen. This is really, really not going to happen. Peter seems to know best. But Peter has no idea what God's plan is. No idea of what the real enemy is. No idea really of where the scriptures are pointing. Peter looks out and sees the Gentiles as the enemy. He sees the wicked and corrupt kings as the enemy. He sees perhaps the corrupt temple practices as the enemy. He has no concept that the real enemy is sin, and this is how God is going to conquer sin. He's going to defeat sin. Peter has no idea that that's what needs to take place. Far be it from you, Lord. This shall never happen to you. Now, it's impossible for him to put everything together. He knew what Jesus has said. He doesn't quite understand it. So he goes and takes this step to correct Jesus. And that earns in itself a correction or a rebuke from Jesus himself. So, verse 23, but he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. So notice how he is corrected by Jesus. So get behind me. We see this kind of the positioning, right? Peter is taking Jesus aside, perhaps away from the other disciples, and he's offering his rebuke to him. And Jesus turns on Peter and gets right into his face and offers his very stern rebuke of Peter. And he tells him basically to take his place, his proper place behind him. Peter, the disciple, was rebuking the teacher, the rabbi. And in that way, Peter is almost attempting to exercise some sort of authority over Jesus, right? You don't correct your teachers. You don't rebuke your rabbis. Not in this culture, right? This is the honor your father and mother. This is honor those that, you know, have the wisdom, right? And especially because this is a discipleship relationship, right? Jesus called him to follow him, which implies that he is behind him, not out front leading him. But here, Jesus tells him to get back in place. Fall back in line. Get behind me. So I think that there's a little bit of that going on. Not just making this a discipleship moment, but he's really getting in Peter's face and setting him straight. You have no place to take me aside and tell me what to do. I'm the king. I'm the teacher. You're the pupil. Listen to me. Now, it's interesting, too, that he addresses him as Satan. And some people kind of speculate, well, you know, Peter was in thinking his human thoughts and setting his mind on the things of man and not on the things of God. You know, Satan has corrupted Peter and perhaps, you know, influenced him, or maybe it possessed him a little bit here. Now, what we have to understand is that Satan is just the word. This is we've done a lot of language stuff the last few weeks, but this is a transliteration of the Greek word Satana, which is a word that means enemy or adversary. So what's interesting is that this is actually alluding back to the temptation of Jesus in the wilderness by the devil, in which Jesus responds to the devil in the same way. Right? Get away from me. Don't tell me who you think the Son of God is, because you don't know. You can twist Scripture and you can make Scripture seem, you know, to fit your approach, but you don't understand the things of God. In the same way, Peter is influenced by this demonic idea that in some way the Christ does not have to suffer. In order for Jesus to take his throne, he does not have to take it on a cross. So Satan, or Peter, is following after the lies of the devil. He is implying that somehow the king can conquer without actually having to suffer and die, to be killed, to be crucified. Somehow Jesus can be enthroned without that happening, which was what the temptation was all about. I think there's even some more allusions to this when Jesus actually gives his disciples the model, right? What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? This is the offer that was made to Jesus in that third temptation, right? I'll give you all the kingdoms of the world if you fall down and worship me. You don't need to obey your father to follow his will and his plan to the cross. You don't need that to have a rule or a kingdom or an authority. All you have to do is bow down and worship me. So that is kind of behind this rebuke. Now notice too that he calls Peter, here it's translated in the ESV, a hindrance. It's actually a stumbling block. So Peter, out in front of Jesus, Peter the rock, is a stumbling block to Jesus. He's actually there tripping Jesus up. He's trying to prevent Jesus from keeping God's will. He's trying to scandalize him. You're a hindrance to me. You're a stumbling block. You are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man. Interesting that this happens immediately after Peter is proclaimed by Jesus to be the rock. Peter, you're a rock. You're a rock on which I'm going to build my church. You're going to be a foundation stone for my church that I'm going to build. But here he's a stumbling block. So papal infallibility, we can just kind of toss that out the window. It doesn't take very long for Peter to show us how many mistakes he can make. Here he's preventing Jesus from following God's will, from obeying his Father. I think that there's kind of a lot going on with this. Peter is only thinking about the things of man. It's interesting that, you know, we look at, we sang about the miracle of regeneration, right? God opens up his word to us. We sing about the way that God gives us life, the way that he opens our minds, helps us to understand things. And that had not yet happened to Peter. It is clear throughout the Gospels that, yes, in one way, they saw maybe perhaps a little bit more than others, but only as much as God would reveal to them. And they had not yet reached the point where they can put everything together. Peter is still in need of having his mind open to the things of God. Now, I think this passage here, these few verses, help us to see that the cross is absolutely necessary. There is no salvation apart from it. There is nothing, and talk about being cross-centered or gospel-centered or something like that. There is nothing that Jesus can do apart from the cross. This is the plan. This is what must happen. This is what the scriptures foretold. This is why Matthew presents Jesus as fulfilling scripture. Because that is where the enemy truly dies. That is where the enemy is truly defeated. That is where the true enemy is truly defeated. The cross and the empty tomb. This is God's plan for his son. And then we see now that this is the shape of discipleship. So look at what happens next. So after Jesus rebukes Peter, Jesus then addresses the disciples. Verse 24. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." This is the call to follow the Christ. You need to count the cost. If anyone who would come after him, anyone who would follow him, you must deny yourself and take up your cross and follow him. The idea here is, I think people read into the verb here as kind of a continuous action, right? You must continue to deny yourself, or deny yourself daily, I think is how Luke says it. Take up your cross and follow me. This is kind of an ongoing thing of discipleship. This is what it looks like to be a disciple. To deny yourself. All of your dreams and hopes and desires, you put those aside. You take up his dreams and his plan and his purposes for your life. And there's a certain sacrifice that has to happen, right? You're setting aside the things that you perhaps desire to do in order to follow after Christ. You deny yourself. You give up your rights and your life for his. You take up your cross, right? Everyone has a cross to bear. And you follow him. I think there's kind of a secondary application that would fit some of that, right? This is a call to self-denial. But we can't allow that to overshadow what it would have meant to his disciples, what he's actually calling them to do. What does it mean to take up your cross? I think I've just alluded to a little bit, but we have a phrase that we use frequently about challenging times, maybe perhaps a difficulty that God brings into your life that you don't really want to deal with, but you have your cross to bear, some sort of challenging person or task or, you know, disability, and we call that our cross. That's the cross that Jesus is calling us to bear. Well, that's not what it means. I think he's speaking, you know, obviously he's not speaking literally. We're going to see some stuff on Friday where people are going to, you know, dress in loincloth and throw some red paint on them and grab a cross beam and carry it through the streets. And I don't know, all over the world, I think people do that. Reenact the bearing of the cross. And they're going to, you know, follow the different stations of the cross and do different things and stuff like that. That's not really what he's describing here. We're not literally fulfilling this, right? What he's describing here is it is a march. It is a, you know, a burden to bear, but he's talking really about death. There would be no way for a person under Roman rule to take up their crossbar and have that not result in death. The Romans were very good at what they did. And it would, of course, we know that it was the worst people that would actually do that. It was the worst criminals that actually were crucified. These are the worst guys. They would be given their cross to carry to their place of execution. That's what Jesus is calling his disciples to. You must give your life in order to follow after me. Now, I think in verse 28, we're going to see that he does not intend for all of them to die. And he predicts that not all of them would die, but they must be willing to do this. This is the cost of following the Christ. Now, I think these are very specific instructions for the disciples. I think there's a way in which it applies to us. The cross was a symbol of death, a symbol of execution. In a way, we can practice self-denial. We can honor Christ out of our loyalty to him and uphold everything and all of his plans that he wants to do. We can submit to those and follow those with all of our heart. And that's what it does look like to be a disciple. To listen to his teachings, to strive to obey him in everything. Not perfectly, but that's what we're striving to do. But we can't let that overshadow what this meant for his disciples. They must be ready to die if that's what's going to happen. If that's a part of God's plan for them. The crucifixion demands cruciformity. The cross shape victory that Jesus won means for us that we must follow in his footsteps. I think this is this would have been a kind of a gruesome conversation, right? We are protected from some of this these gruesome forms of execution. So this would have really challenged the disciples and whatever commitment they thought they had made to Jesus. And I think in part of the way we're somewhat protected from the persecution that they faced, right? Jesus is preparing them for the tribulation. He's preparing them for the difficult times that they're going to face out of their loyalty to him, out of following him. They must be ready for death, willing to give up their lives if that's what God's plan is. We don't necessarily face that same persecution. So I think some of this is unrelated to our experiences. But the call is still the same. What does loyalty to Jesus look like in a culture that is increasingly hostile to a Christian worldview, to God's truth? What are you willing to give up? If you haven't been thinking about that this year, then you need to start thinking about that. Because that seems to be the direction things are headed. So it could be jail time. It could be a loss of a job. It could be violence. We don't know. But you must be prepared for that. Think through those things. Consider what it will cost you to be loyal to Jesus. And the beauty of it is that this is the way not to die. This is the way to live. That's the promise that he gives. This is the principle that's outlined here. Verse 25, for whoever would save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. So if you want to live, then what you must do is die. Die to your dreams and your desires and your purposes and your plans, and you take up those of the crucified King. That's how you live. That's how you truly find life. You don't find it by protecting yourself from all of those negative things that could be bringing, that the world could be bringing into your life, by accumulating all of your possessions, by striving to preserve your life. That is not how you find life. That's actually how you lose it. You must give it up. Lose your life for his sake. Not just a general, you know, a life of self-denial. This is a life of self-denial and taking up your cross for Jesus' sake. Meaning you're doing it for him. You're doing what he wants you to do. That's how you find your life. Now there's the word life translated there is the word soul, which is the way it's translated in verse 26. You think, well, what is it actually describing? Physical life? There's more to it than just physical life, right? He's not telling you to physically die so that you could physically live. That's not what he's actually describing, though it could mean physical death. Verse 26 is about the value of one's life or one's soul, right? What will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? So speaking about the comparison then between all that the world has to offer, you could be, you know, you could have 100,000 bitcoins or something like that. All that the world has to offer, everything that's there for you to possess, how can you exchange that for one's life, for one's soul? What is of more value? All of those things are temporary, but your life, your soul, is eternal. What shall a man give in return for his soul? What is there that you can give in exchange for one's life? Is there anything of comparison? Is there anything that this world has to offer that is worth one life? Obviously, these are rhetorical, but his point is that the life, the soul, your soul is of more value than anything the world has to offer. Do you consider it to be of more value than what the world has to offer? Do you place that much value upon your own life? Jesus says, if you do, then you give it up. Because that's the way that you'll have it. Now, I think what he does now is that he gives a little glimpse for the disciples of the eternal nature of their life or of their soul. Okay? Verse 27. So don't just be thinking of your life here now. Think, have an eternal perspective. Why? Because verse 27 tells us what is going to happen. The Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. The Son of Man will come, Daniel chapter 7, in the glory of his Father with his angels in judgment. And specifically for his disciples, what he's going to judge, he's going to judge them here, it says, for what each person, according to what he has done, in context, referring to how they have responded to him. Have they denied themselves and taken up their cross and followed him? Or have they fed themselves with every sort of desire that they have? Have they refused to take up their cross and follow him? So this cost then is, I think, reinforced by this statement of judgment. The disciples are to be aware of what God is going to do, what the Son of Man will do when he comes in the glory of his Father with his angels, where he comes to judge each man according to what they have done. Think of that and allow that moment to influence your decision here and now. What this means for those that have denied themselves and taken up their cross is that they will have a day of vindication, a day of reward, a day in which God, in his judgment seat, and the books are opened, a day in which they will be vindicated, that whatever they gave up here out of loyalty to Jesus for his sake, they will receive back a hundredfold. I think that's meant to be not just an encouragement to them that were facing dark times, but it was going to help them make the decision that they had to make. Don't just think about protecting your life or saving face or being accepted by your friends. Think about that day, the day when the Son of Man comes. I think this is encouraging. And I think we've already seen glimpses of this in the gospel. Think specifically of the two parables that we've looked at. The parable of the wheat and the tares. The parable of the dragnet. We see that this judgment takes place at the end of the age. The end of the age in which at the harvest, the wheat, the tares, the weeds are separated from the wheat. The Son of Man, this is what it says in Matthew 13, the Son of Man will send his angels, and they will gather out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all lawbreakers, and throw them into the fiery furnace. You think of the dragnet, that's this net that is cast out and the men drag it to shore. And once they do that, they start to separate out the good fish from the bad fish. The bad fish they toss, the good fish they store in containers. I think this is describing the judgment that takes place at the end of the age. Now look at what Jesus says in verse 28. Truly, amen, verily, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now this is kind of a, I don't know if you call it an oath of sorts or a promise or just prediction or, you know, I don't know how you want to call this the statement here, but look at the way that Jesus emphasizes this. So truly, he's wanting them to make sure that this is God's truth. This is a verifiable statement. I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now this verse gives us the time frame in which we should expect to see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now, obviously, with anything related to eschatology, there are a variety of viewpoints. What is Jesus talking about? From what I have read, I think there's probably like four or five different perspectives, right? This is either referring to the transfiguration, this is either referring to transfiguration, the resurrection, Pentecost, or the church age of some sort, right? It's kind of this ongoing duration of time. Interesting that, you know, the transfiguration follows this passage, right? That's the very next passage. Chapter 17, verse 1, and after 6 days, Jesus took him. So even referring back to that time, the transfiguration taking place 6 days after this statement. I think if you think about the transfiguration here, Jesus is saying that some standing here will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. He would then be telling his disciples that within the next week, some of you guys are not going to die. Which seems to be kind of a ridiculous statement. If this is referring to the resurrection, which we know we're months away from that happening, then he would be telling his disciples that some of them will still be alive when Jesus is raised. Some of you guys are going to survive the year. Congratulations. Of course, if the coming of the Son of Man in his kingdom takes place after the disciples die, as if it was still in our future in this sense, then Jesus' statement would be wrong. This led one scholar to describe this saying as chronologically incorrect. That sounds nice, I guess. So what is Jesus actually getting at? I think we've already seen when we looked at the parables, we see that the end of the age is, you know, that the time in which the tares and are separated from the weeds and the bad fish are thrown out. We've seen that this is something that was anticipated by the Jews. They were waiting for that end to take place. They were waiting for that evil age to end so that the glorious age of the Messiah would begin, right? And there was this point in which, on Thursday, the age, the evil age ends, and on Friday, the new age begins. And what we see happening, though, throughout the New Testament is that there's actually an overlap between those two, that one age has not ended yet, and while there's a new age that has begun. So we see things that were expected to take place in the new age, the age to come. We see those things happening after Jesus' death and resurrection. And yet we still don't see the end of the age. So there's this overlap between the two. And I think that once we put all of these facts together, specifically once we get to Matthew 24, we'll see that the symbol of the end of the age was the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. So listen to what Jesus says in Matthew 24. Listen to how similar this sounds to what he's describing here. Then will appear in heaven the sign of the Son of Man, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And he will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. That sounds similar to what's being described here. And when you put this over on top of Daniel 7, you'll see all of those things taking place. When you add in the idea of the parables and what the parables are describing, you'll see that they actually provide details of what that end of the age looks like, when there is going to be a separation, there is going to be a judgment, there is going to be a vindication or salvation of sorts. Now, we can't obviously get into all of that here. We're going to have to postpone some of that until we get to Matthew 24. But listen to how R.C. Sproul supports this. He says that the importance of this consideration is its relationship to our understanding of the disputed time frame reference in the Olivet Discourse. That's Matthew 24. So the time frame reference that he's talking about is when Jesus says that all these things will take place within this generation. Before this generation passes away, all of these things will take place. That's what he says in Matthew 24. And Sproul is making the connection between that time reference and this one right here. If Jesus had in mind a time frame of roughly 40 years, it could also be said that during this time frame, some of his disciples would not taste death. If the Olivet Discourse refers primarily to events surrounding the destruction of Jerusalem, and if the word generation refers to a 40-year period, then it is possible, if not probable, that Jesus' reference to his coming in Matthew 16:28 refers to the same events, not to the transfiguration or other close-at-hand events. What he's saying is that it makes most sense, considering all of what the Bible says about the coming of the Son of Man, and his statement here to not just expect or describe something that's going to happen 6 days later or several months later, but 40 years later, a generation later. It would make most sense for Jesus to say that some of you standing here right now listening to my words will not die before you see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom at the end of the age. So then, how does this reinforce the passage? This is what Jesus is describing for his disciples. The disciples are to count the cost of following the Christ, especially considering the hostility that they will face for doing so. They are to look past the temporary to the eternal, where their Lord and King will vindicate them for their loyalty and judge their enemies. Some of them will live to see that day. Some won't, but they will all be looking forward to it. So Jesus puts this coming, this moment for those who count the cost and follow Christ, this moment out there for them, setting it out there as a goal. This is what you're looking for. This is what you're waiting for. So strive to follow after me. Strive to take up your cross and follow me. Your day of vindication is near. So I think this reinforces, it not only motivates them to be faithful, but it reinforces for them that, yes, they must persevere, endure, strive side by side for the sake of the gospel and loyalty to Christ. Endure the hardships that you're going to go through. Endure the difficulty. And yes, there was tons of difficulty and challenges for them. Some gave their lives, but all of them were waiting for the moment in which the Son of Man would be vindicated. The Son of Man would receive his eternal kingdom, his dominion, his eternal kingdom that would last forever, forever, and ever. That's the motivation that they're given. The cross is a necessity. They must die, just like the Christ. But you know what? What comes after the cross? Glory, salvation, vindication. You can't have that without death. Jesus can't have that without death. It is necessary for him to go to Jerusalem to suffer and to be killed. But then comes glory. Let's pray.